deadly Russian strikes in Ukraine as allies pledge more aid.
The only way it'll work is if Ukraine has the capacity to disrupt Russia's economy by hitting its power infrastructure.
Plus, could the next president bring dramatic changes to U.S. foreign policy?
Certainly have to put Russia and China near the top of any list of traditional threats, and probably even at the top of even a broader list that includes climate change and pandemic and so forth, because, you know, things are so tense right now, and the possibility of war is non-trivial.
And Red Cross aid workers killed in Donetsk. Typhoon Yagi wreaks havoc in Southeast Asia. And Australia strips military honors over war crimes in Afghanistan.
Today is Thursday, September 12th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint.
Good evening, I'm Steve Karish, along with Lori London. Russian drones inflicted significant damage to Ukrainian infrastructure across the country, leaving at least one city without drinking water or natural gas for cooking and heating. The attacks came while U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and British Foreign Secretary David Lammy were visiting Kyiv to pledge support, including nearly $1.5 billion in additional aid. As VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gungadze reports, Kyiv, in turn, requested the two allies lift restrictions on using Western weapons to strike targets inside Russia.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and British Foreign Secretary David Lammy made a joint visit to Kyiv, Ukraine, Wednesday at the news conference with newly appointed Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha. Blinken affirmed the United States and Britain's backing of Kyiv's defense.
Here today, the United States, the United Kingdom, are united in support of Ukraine and its success. Putin will not outlast the coalition of countries committed to Ukraine's success, and he is certainly not going to outlast the Ukrainian people.
The Ukrainians thanked the U.S. and Britain for pledged additional support of nearly $1.5 billion in aid, much of it to go toward the energy grid. However, Ukraine repeated its request that restrictions be lifted on striking targets deep in Russia using Western weapons, like the U.S.'s ATACMS and Britain's Storm Shadow missiles. Their use is currently limited to Russian targets within occupied Ukrainian territory. On the day of the visit, 17 former American and British diplomats and military leaders published an open letter urging Blinken and Lammy to change the weapons policy. U.S. lawmakers from both parties have made similar appeals to the Biden administration this week. Ukrainian lawmaker Volodymyr Vyatorovich pointed out that lifting the restrictions was essential for Ukraine's defense.
I believe at this stage of the war, one of the key issues which should have indicated a change in the United States' approach to this war is the possibility of using, including American weapons, against targets deep within the Russian Federation.
This week, U.S. President Joe Biden said his administration was working on the possibility of lifting these sanctions. Irian Karatnitsky, a non-resident senior fellow at the U.S.-based think tank Atlantic Council, argues that changes in Western policy are necessary for Ukraine to either secure victory or force Russia into a peace agreement acceptable to the Ukrainian people.
The only way it'll work is if Ukraine has the capacity to disrupt Russia's economy by hitting its power infrastructure, and long-range missiles are needed for that.
Russian Duma Speaker Vyacheslav Volodin said Wednesday that if the U.S. and its partners allowed the use of long-range weapons, Moscow would consider the United States and its allies as direct parties to the war. Ukrainian MP Vyatorovich argues U.S. leaders to stop fearing escalation and to look at the big picture.
Only after the military defeat of the Russian Federation in this most aggressive war will there be a chance for us to return to a world where international legal acts are respected, where adherence to international legal norms is possible.
Blinken was due to stop in Warsaw on Thursday to meet with his Polish counterpart and reaffirm the U.S. commitment to collective defense and NATO. Miroslava Gungadze, VOA News, Warsaw.
In a related and still developing story, three staff members of the International Committee of the Red Cross were killed on Thursday as artillery hit the site of a planned frontline aid distribution center in the Donetsk region. Two additional ICRC staff members were wounded. Follow VOAnews.com for more details as they become available.
Americans got a closer look this week at presidential candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump in a debate Tuesday night. It's still not totally clear how each would approach foreign policy and national security issues. Would a Harris presidency be a continuation of the Biden administration? And how dramatic of a change would a second Trump term be regarding U.S. relations with allies and adversaries? I spoke with Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow and director of research in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. What's at stake here regarding whoever becomes the next president?
You'd certainly have to put Russia and China near the top of any list of traditional threats, and probably even at the top of even a broader list that includes climate change and pandemic and so forth, because, you know, things are so tense right now and the possibility of war is non-trivial. It's not in the high probability range, but even a lower probability is scary when you're talking about nuclear armed adversaries. So I certainly think that at the issues level, given that the Russian war in Ukraine continues, given that China's acute threat to Taiwan and its rapid rise continue, those two focal points need to be front and center. And so the question really becomes, for me at least, would Trump be sort of like he was in the first term, where on balance, his bark was worse than his bite, and he wound up threatening to break off alliances and threatening war with North Korea and things like that, and usually pulled back? Or would Trump be more disruptive? Would he come out of the blocks with a much more disruptive agenda and really try to fundamentally change the way we've operated by on a bipartisan basis roughly since 1945? That is by far and away for me the biggest question. Which Trump would you get?
And if that were the case, that he did follow through on some of the things he promises, and how could that impact national security and global peace?
I'm most concerned about questions of war and peace, mm-hmm. and whether a war happened that might otherwise be preventable. And, you know, Trump, I just wrote a piece on this where I'm basically saying, comparing Trump and Harris as prospective future presidents, and ask, to what extent do we know how to interpret Trump? And on the one hand, to be fair and to be empirical, based on what he did as president the first time, he did not start new wars, and he likes to brag about that. And I appreciate hearing him brag about it, not because I give him as much credit as he gives himself, but because I'm glad to know that there's a peacenik side to him, that he actually considers it a virtue not to have started any wars. That's encouraging. On the other hand, he is so impetuous in certain situations where a certain steadiness is really important that I worry that he could send the wrong message. For example, you know, he talks about how maybe he wouldn't defend Taiwan because they don't necessarily do enough for their own security. And why should the United States have to then go in and bail them out? Well, that's extremely dangerous rhetoric when keeping the peace vis-a-vis China over Taiwan is largely a question of persuading China that we very well might fight if they attack Taiwan, that we very well might come to Taiwan's defense. And so if Trump is all over the place rhetorically, I worry that that could increase the chances of war. And then with Putin and Russia and Ukraine, Trump clearly goes into this whole Russia-Ukraine situation with a lot of contradictory sentiments. He likes Putin more than he seems to like half our NATO allies, and yet he would inherit a war that is Russia's decision and Russia's fault, where the United States has been crucial in helping Ukraine survive as a country. Mm-hmm. And is Trump really going to pull the plug on that? I just think it's impossible to read him. And he claims he has a plan for how to end the war in 24 hours through compromise and negotiation. That probably implies freezing the territorial division right where the front line is now. And I fear that shows that Trump's not realistic, because neither Zelensky nor Putin would accept that kind of a compromise right now. The greatest dangers would be that an adversary would misinterpret Trump's resoluteness, or that Trump himself would get very frustrated with the situation and decide to employ brinkmanship.
And about Kamala Harris, do you see her continuing pretty much in line with President Biden?
I think that she's going to want to be seen as a change agent on issues where we're bogged down right now, most specifically the Gaza crisis and the U.S.-Mexico border crisis and possibly Ukraine. So on those issues, I think, at least for political posturing, she'll want to be seen as a change agent, even though she is Biden's vice president. And, you know, one of the things about Harris that contributed to the fact that if she had run in an open primary, she probably would not have gotten the nomination, is that she was not really seen as all that instrumental in Biden's big decision making on foreign policy. That may be untrue. They may have a closer relationship than I ever was able to appreciate, or most of us were able to see. But she may have, therefore, the benefit of a certain space, a certain plausibility that she really is considerably different than Biden. However, I think that in the end, she's going to be advised by, you know, solid centrist foreign policy experts from the Democratic Party, many of whom have been part of the Biden and Obama and Clinton worlds previously. And so she's coming out of a tradition that I don't think she's likely to deviate that far from fundamentally. It's moderate on security issues. It's pro-arms control, but realistic. It's tough on China, but still keep the dialogue going. Supportive of NATO and Ukraine. These big pillars of foreign policy thinking, I would expect that she would adopt most of them.
Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Research in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution.
Israel has continued its military raids in the occupied West Bank on Thursday, saying it's working to dismantle militant groups and to prevent increasing militant attacks on Israelis. The Red Crescent said on Wednesday three people were killed in a strike on a car in a village outside Tel Karam. The Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, confirmed it carried out a strike, but provided no immediate details. Sami Massoud was there. He says the explosions were close to him and that he saw a young man and a vehicle hit by a missile. As he and others rushed to help, he saw three bodies inside the vehicle, one of which was decapitated by the blast. Palestinians say such operations are aimed at cementing Israel's seemingly open-ended military rule over the territory. This follows IDF assaults around the West Bank town of Tel Karam on Wednesday. The IDF said it dismantled an explosives lab, a weapons manufacturing workshop, and a vehicle rigged with explosives. The IDF also said an airstrike backing troops operating in the town of Tubas killed five militants. The Palestinian Health Ministry confirmed five were killed, but did not specify if they were militants or civilians.
Moving to Southeast Asia, Thailand's new prime minister, Pithongtorn Shinawatra, outlined her government's policy agenda on Thursday. Francis McGuire with Reuters brings us details.
It was headlined by plans to give away $13.4 billion in handouts to jumpstart the economy.
The government will push to stimulate the economy, build trust, and encourage spending in line with mitigating the people's burden and costs, as well as increase job opportunities, where we will give priority to the most vulnerable group first.
Pithongtorn's cabinet was sworn in this month. Her policies include debt restructuring and legalizing casinos to draw in investment and more tourists. Pithongtorn said Thailand faced challenges with structural economic problems and vowed to act with urgency to stimulate growth. But the Prime Minister gave no update on how or when the handout of $300 to 50 million people would be rolled out. The government had said this week it would distribute $4.2 billion of the program to support vulnerable groups later this month. The scheme has been criticised by economists and former central bank governors as fiscally irresponsible. But the government rejects that argument despite struggling to find sources of funding. Ministers insist the policy is necessary to energise the economy as it struggles to grow compared to regional peers.
That was Francis McGuire with Reuters.
All this as residents in Thailand and neighboring Vietnam are still reeling from severe flooding triggered by the deadly Typhoon Yagi. A conservation expert says climate change and poor disaster preparedness combined to cause a devastating impact after Asia's strongest storm this year. Diane To of Reuters reports.
Parts of Vietnam remained severely flooded on Wednesday after the deadly Typhoon Yagi hammered the Southeast Asian nation with gales and torrential rain. In Thai Nguyen, some 50 miles from the capital Hanoi, residents rowed their canoes through the streets while others tried to salvage what they could of their belongings. This man said it's the worst flood he's ever seen and that the ground floor of his home was entirely underwater. It's a similar situation for this woman who said her property was destroyed in the storm. Officials have reported scores of people dead and missing, mostly from flash floods and landslides. Authorities in Hanoi evacuated thousands of people from their homes along the Red River as its waters rose to a 20-year high. Yagi was the most powerful typhoon to hit Asia this year, bringing catastrophic flash flooding to neighboring Thailand as well. At least two people were killed and hundreds stranded after heavy rains swept through two northern provinces, swelling rivers, inundating settlements and triggering mudslides, Thai authorities said on Wednesday. And about 9,000 households have been impacted.
The flooding that we have seen.
Thai conservation scientist Pech Manopawit said climate change and disaster mismanagement are to blame for the devastation at hand.
The rain intensity is so high that now we have the new term, right, that called rain bomb, because of the rain intensity that has never before existed. And I think this also overwhelmed our infrastructure that used to perhaps deal with a much less volume of water. And on top of that, we didn't do well enough in terms of preparedness.
Manopawit, who is also a government advisor, said the floods should be a wake-up call for policymakers.
So the government, I think, have to really realize about there's no economy on the dead planet. And now there's so much crisis happening around us. We have to really think differently in terms of driving economic forward.
That's Diane To of Reuters reporting for us today.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Lori London with Steve Karish in Washington. Australia has stripped military honors from senior defense commanders over alleged war crimes committed under their watch during the long conflict in Afghanistan. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Australian Defence Minister Richard Marles Thursday told the federal parliament senior military officers who served in Afghanistan would lose their Distinguished Service Medals. Stripping some commanders of their medals was recommended by the 2020 Brereton Report, which dealt with war crimes allegedly committed during the war in Afghanistan. It found credible evidence elite Australian soldiers had unlawfully killed 39 people during the conflict. Miles told Parliament senior officers were responsible for the actions of their units.
When you command a unit, you will receive often the benefits and the accolades of what that unit does, irrespective of whether you've personally been right there at the front line, and commensurately you accept the responsibility of that unit in terms of what failings occur.
The government hasn't said how many officers have had their military honours rescinded, but media reports say the decision affects up to 9 serving and former military commanders. They've not necessarily been accused of war crimes, but have been punished for allegedly ignoring or not reporting misconduct by their troops. Andrew Hastie is Australia's shadow defence minister and a former military officer who served in Afghanistan. He told Parliament Thursday that commanders had an obligation to oversee the actions of their soldiers.
Those who are alleged to have shed innocent blood are alone responsible for that. I do not say this to absolve or condemn anyone, but those in the chain of command who saw the pictures of dead individuals had an obligation to ask questions.
The government has stressed that the vast majority of Australian service personnel who were sent to Afghanistan between 2001 and 2021 had given sacred service, and it commended those who helped expose alleged wrongdoing. Dozens of Australian soldiers are reportedly being investigated for alleged war crimes. So far, charges have only been laid against one. Phil Mercer, VOA News. Sydney.
Peru's controversial former president, Alberto Fujimori, died Wednesday at the age of 86. Fujimori steered economic growth through the 1990s but was later jailed for human rights abuses. His supporters say he saved Peru from terrorism and economic collapse.
Botswana and an American biotech firm, Ginkgo Bioworks, have partnered to conduct pathogen surveillance at the country's entry points. Health officials say the proactive move is meant to safeguard public health as the world faces emergency disease threats. Steve Miller narrates this story by Mukandis Dube.
Botswana introduced Mpox screening last month for travelers at its entry points. In a statement Wednesday, Ministry of Health spokesperson Christopher Nyaga said a pathogen monitoring program is critical to detecting similar emerging health threats.
In a proactive effort to safeguard public health, the Ministry of Health, in collaboration with Ginkgo Bioworks LLC, will on 16 September 2024 introduce a pathogen monitoring program in certain ports of entry. This new initiative is part of government's efforts to strengthen detection of new and emerging public health threats across Botswana's borders.
Dr. Mbachi Mazwiduma, a public health expert, says the pathogen surveillance program will complement existing strategies to prevent disease threats.
The initiative by the Ministry of Health is a very welcome development, in the sense that at least it is demonstrating that they are both embracing traditional methods of surveillance and disease detection, plus at the same time they are looking at other innovative ways of disease detection.
Through the collaboration, Boston-based Ginkgo Bioworks will work with the Ministry of Health to collect and monitor traveler samples. Nasal swabs will be used to collect the samples. Nyaga says testing will be done on a voluntary, anonymous basis. But Mazwiduma says voluntary participation in the pathogen monitoring program could hinder effective disease detection.
Perhaps if it is non-invasive and non-intrusive, then the technique should be compulsory, because at least it ensures that the number of people who comply to sample acquisition is increased, and therefore you can actually rapidly achieve suitable sample sizes for you to be able to ensure that, number one, you don't miss any patients, but also more importantly that it allows you to improve your validation of these particular technologies.
Botswana and Ginkgo Bioworks previously collaborated in a 2022 pathogen monitoring program to detect new and emerging COVID-19 variants. During the same year, Botswana was credited with the discovery of COVID-19 variant Omicron. For Mkandasi Dube, I'm Steve Miller, VOA News.
Media in Senegal reports that at least 35 people have died when their overloaded boat sank shortly after leaving the fishing port of Mbour on the Senegalese coast. Many others are reported missing. The people were headed to the Canary Islands, which is Spanish territory and a popular destination for migrants looking to enter the EU. Standing on the beach, Senegal's president, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, addressed the nation.
It is with great sadness that I stand here today in the face of this human tragedy that has shaken us all. The nation is in mourning, and the situation is particularly untenable. I would like to express my condolences on behalf of this nation, the Senegalese nation, to the bereaved family.
Faye blames the tragedy on traffickers, and he said that from now on, the relentless hunt for these illusion peddlers, these peddlers of death, he called them, will be stepped up. A hotline will be set up for people to report the activities of such traffickers, he added. More than 22,000 migrants have already landed in the Canary Islands so far this year, more than twice the number from the previous year. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Lori London and everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.